world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ore Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. For a few years, the threat of Somali pirates in the Indian Ocean has been considered pretty much crushed. But last November came a sea change. They're back, and dealing with them this time around could prove harder. And you may have mixed feelings about the potential of artificial intelligence, but it can do some impressive tricks with music and with podcasts just like this one. What could this all mean for producers and composers? First up, though. Today, Kishida Fumio, Japan's Prime Minister, is meeting President Joe Biden in Washington. Mr. Kishida and his wife were welcomed by the President and First Lady after arriving yesterday. This evening, they will have dinner together in the White House, the first such meeting between the heads of the two countries since Barack Obama invited Shinzo Abe in 2015. The hope will be to deepen defense and security cooperation between the two nations, something that is becoming increasingly important as the global winds of power shift.
Joe Biden, in his 4 years as president, has welcomed four leaders to the White House for state dinners. Kishida Fumio, Japan's prime minister, is going to become the fifth. So it's a big deal.
Noah Snyder is The Economist's Tokyo bureau chief.
And it's significant that he's also the third of these five to come from an Indo-Pacific ally of America, which tells you, I think, a bit about how important this region is to America and to the current administration's strategy in the world, even as crises rage elsewhere. American officials are really touting it as evidence of how its alliances in Asia are evolving to meet the challenge of a rising China, but also of a more belligerent North Korea and a much more unstable and contested environment throughout the region. And what they don't say, but what's also, of course, looming behind all of this is a desire to reinforce these alliances, to sort of insulate these relationships from any potential damage that Donald Trump might be able to do if he were reelected as America's president this November.
Now, why is America and Japan's relationship so important?
Well, so I think we ought to take a little bit of a step back here and just refresh our memory on what the Asian security architecture really looks like. And unlike in NATO, where America has a multilateral alliance where an attack on one member is an attack on all, in Asia, it developed in the wake of the Second World War a set of discrete bilateral treaties, which came together into a system that we now call a hub and spokes. So America's the hub, and it's got a bunch of spokes with Japan, with South Korea, with the Philippines, with Australia, and with Thailand. And part of what's been happening under the Biden administration, certainly in accelerated form, is an effort to make links between these various spokes, to try and create new groupings, new partnerships, new formats that get America's allies talking with each other and collaborating, especially on security issues. And Japan is really central to that effort. It sits at the heart of several of these new groupings, for example, a trilateral arrangement with South Korea, another trilateral arrangement with the Philippines. And it has both economic resources and heft to make a difference. And it also sits on the front line geographically and geostrategically when thinking about potential regional flashpoints, in particular around Taiwan.
So this is a meeting between Japan and America, but it's not necessarily about just Japan and America.
That's absolutely right, Ore. And I think Japan in particular is keen to make the case that it has evolved from not only being a kind of regional partner for America, but a global partner. That the conversations that Japan and America are having are not just about internal alliance issues or investment and trade issues, as they tended to be in the past, but they're about how both countries can work together to shape the Indo-Pacific and to shape the global environment to their mutual advantage. And I think one piece of evidence of this trend is the fact that tomorrow, so a day after Biden and Kishida have their state dinner, Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos, the president of the Philippines, is going to join them for a separate summit, the first leader-level trilateral meeting between those three countries. So again, it's really an effort to work together regionally to build links between allies, not just between Japan and America themselves.
And you mentioned earlier the prospect of Trump's re-election. Why is there so much concern about what his re-election might mean for these alliances?
Well, I think the fundamental point is that his first term just shook allies' confidence in America's reliability. I mean, America went, as one official in the region here put it to me, from being a constant to being a variable. There's just a deep uncertainty about what kind of role America would play if Trump were reelected. And beyond Trump himself, I think there are deeper enduring concerns and questions about America's ability to maintain its global obligations, given the deep internal divisions in American society, and given the trend, even under Joe Biden, towards a protectionist anti-trade mentality, which allies here in Asia find really dismaying. So the anxiety about Trump has a kind of acute form. And here in Japan, there's even a catchphrase that speaks to it. People here say Moshitora, which essentially means, you know, what if Trump? Even if Trump is solid when it comes to Asia, there's also concern about the ripple effects of a potential move to abandon Ukraine and essentially allow Russia to prevail in its war there. Prime Minister Kishida told me and a group of other reporters before he went to Washington that if that happened, it would really send the wrong signal to Asia. So there are many reasons to fear a Trump 2.0.
Noah, what do you expect to come out of today's meeting?
So I think there are likely to be a number of big ticket announcements, in particular on defense and security. I think you'll see an announcement of looming reforms to the command and control structures that Japan and America's armed forces operate under, probably an announcement on a defense industrial council that will be set up to work on production and procurement of arms. There might also be some slightly awkward conversations on the economic front, in particular around President Biden's opposition to the takeover of U.S. Steel, an American steel manufacturer, by Nippon Steel, a Japanese one. But all in all, I think they're going to try to present a united and chummy front to position, again, the U.S.-Japan alliance as a global partnership, as a growing part of America's architecture in Asia. But underlying all of this is going to be the fact that without America, none of this really adds up. That for the hub and spoke system in Asia, you still really need the hub to be a hub, no matter how much more the spokes are doing.
Noah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
Just over a decade ago, the waters of the Indian Ocean off the coast of Somalia were considered the most dangerous in the world.
Royal Navy personnel have rescued the crew of an Italian cargo ship hijacked by Somali pirates.
Pirate attacks on commercial shipping were a constant and very real threat. Hundreds of ships were targeted, thousands of hostages taken, and some even killed. An international effort to fight off and deter the pirates all but ended the attacks. But now, the threat is emerging again.
Last month, pirates hijacked the Abdullah, which is a Bangladeshi-flagged ship carrying coal from Mozambique to the UAE.
Liam Taylor writes about Africa for The Economist.
The crew is still being held hostage weeks later, and that's the latest in a recent string of attacks around the Horn of Africa off the Somali coast, which really started in November. There's been a notable surge since then, according to the EU's naval force, which is based in the region.
Okay, but from what I understand, the EU's naval force is part of what has prevented these pirate attacks in the last decade. So what's behind the resurgence?
It's certainly one factor in a whole series of measures which have been taken to try and deter piracy over the last decade. So as well as naval patrols, ships and shipping companies have themselves taken more actions to protect themselves, including the use of armed guards on board vessels. And as well, there have been heavy prison sentences for pirates to try and deter them. But unfortunately, over the last few months, much of the attention in the region has been focused on Houthi attacks on ships in the Red Sea. And that has taken some of the focus away from the deterrence of Somali pirates. One shipping expert I spoke to said that pirates are now making hay while the sun shines. Since November, three merchant ships have been attacked and at least 18 dhows, which are smaller, more local boats, have been hijacked.
So with Western naval forces a bit distracted, what else can be done?
So the big power which has come into the region to try and fight piracy is India. It's reported to have at least 12 warships in the region, and it's keen to emphasise its role in providing security across the Indian Ocean. They thwarted one attack on a ship in January, and then last month, in a quite dramatic operation, Indian commandos rescued the crew that had been held captive on another ship for 3 months. But of course, deterrence and military power only goes so far. The deeper causes of piracy lie in Somalia itself.
Tell me more about those deeper causes.
So I spoke to Abdi Nasir Yusuf, who works for a civil society group called the Puntland Development and Research Centre, which is based in the area of Somalia where many of the attacks are coming from. He pointed to two local factors. One was political strife before state elections in January, which distracted local security forces who, rather than trying to control piracy, were more concerned with some of the political dynamics that were going on. And the second factor he pointed to was illegal fishing by foreign fishing vessels which enter Somali waters and are catching fish which normally Somali fisherfolk would be catching. Some of those vessels come from Iran, some come from other countries as well. And the frustration of Somali fisherfolk who are losing opportunities and livelihoods is providing criminal gangs with ready recruits.
So, Liam, given all that, do you think we could see a return to the same level of attacks as just over a decade ago?
I mean, it's important to underline that the recent attacks are barely a ripple compared to what was going on in 2011 at the peak of the previous wave. That year, more than 1,200 mariners were held hostage, 35 died. The World Bank estimated that in the years around 2011, about $53 million was being collected by pirates in ransom every year. And the trade costs to the world economy, the knock-on effects, were estimated at about $18 billion a year. A return to piracy on that level still seems unlikely. Presumably, at some point, that window of opportunity provided by the Houthis will close. But still, the impact right now for shipping is significant. They are seeing increased costs. They're having to steer a wide berth around Somalia as attacks are happening far out to sea.
Liam, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
AI models can now create music with a simple text prompt and the click of a mouse. Music just like the song that you're listening to now. Traditionalists fear that this will edge humans out of the music production process and that the charts will be flooded with generic and emotionally barren tunes. But there is a counterpoint to that. musicians and AI can actually work together in perfect harmony.
It's important that we don't have fear, but in fact, people can learn to use AI as a tool to enhance their job.
David Ludwig is the dean of the Juilliard School's music division. He's training the next generation of composers to make use of AI.
Part of my role is as a guide, so that I can say to a student, well, have you thought about using AI to help you? We don't want it to remove creativity at all. We don't want it to lessen creativity, but to enhance it. This is a program called Sibelius, and it's a notation program. These programs have been around as long as I've been composing. I've written down here a melody, which will be very familiar to most people. What I'm going to do actually is say to the computer, I'd like to change this up, please. So we're going to make it very expressive. We're going to use lots of rubato. Rubato is literally to rob time. And then for rhythmic feel, let's do a jazz waltz. So now it's transformed. What's interesting is I've given the computer a kind of agency. What I'm going to look at now is called Sunos. So this is a text prompt. I'm going to ask the program here to write an aria in the style of Henry Purcell. Henry Purcell was one of the great Baroque era composers of English music. So let's listen to Ode to the Eternal Flame.
The use of AI models to make music isn't new. In fact, some of the first models go back to the 1950s.
Benjamin Sutherland writes about technology for The Economist.
These models painstakingly translated music theory into sets of instructions, but the outputs for these types of models were limited as far as creativity goes. The clearest demonstration that things have really changed came last August when Meta, Facebook's parent, released the source code of a suite of AI music models called AudioCraft. These were built using machine learning. All sorts of outfits around the world started to use Meta's software code to train new music models. These models basically produce new sounds in response to prompts entered by the user. In September, a company called Stability AI released a model called Stable Audio, which users can guide by entering text and audio clips. So let's start with a trance track. Now let's enter some props for ambient house, new age, meditation. Now let's try some post-rock with guitars and drums. And maybe even a drum solo. What you can hear is just the beginning of what these prompt models can do. The potential is vast.
But it sounds pretty cool to me, but why are some people so critical of the current models?
A lot of people feel that AI is never going to produce true music. As one person put it to me, AI models have never had their heart broken. You also have a lot of musicians worried that AI models are going to be using artists' work to make money without those artists getting paid. It's important right now to take a look at another main use for AI in music, which is not generating new music, but rather empowering human composers.
And how can AI be used by human composers?
Well, one way is AI is empowering amateurs, so-called bedroom producers. AI can handle all kinds of technical tasks that are beyond many people's capability and means. So, for instance, a program called RX can correct errors in things like pitch. And AI is also serving professional composers, too. Consider the soundtrack to Barbie.
When I wake up in my own pink world, I get up
that was cleaned in post-production using RX.
Interesting. We actually use RX to clean up voices on this podcast. Ben, what other creative ways are music producers using AI?
AI tools exist to recreate singers' voices in other languages. One of these is Vocaloid, a voice synthesizing tool from Yamaha. It uses a translation sung by a native speaker as a template for AI to imitate as it rearranges, modifies, and stitches together tiny snippets of the original singer's voice. Accomplished musicians now widely use AI as a source of inspiration, a way to quickly and inexpensively generate ideas to determine what does and does not work. Now, whether such inspiration pays off will ultimately be up to listeners to decide.
Benjamin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. As always, you can let us know what you think of the show by getting in touch at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.